Wishes come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Joining me on today's episode of On the Wing Podcast is a guy you may know as the host of the Reverend Hunter Podcast. You also may recognize his voice as the man who's given extremely stirring invocations at the last two Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic national banquets. His talk in front of the Sioux Falls event was particularly exceptional. It was very moving. His name, person I'm talking about, is Tony Jones, and Tony is the author of a brand new book, The God of Wild Places, subtitled Rediscovering the Divine in the Untamed Outdoors. On today's episode, we're going to talk about this new book, which may surprise you, is filled with pheasant hunting and bird dog stories. It's also filled with Tony's connection to spirituality through bird hunting and bird dogs. We'll also preview the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Rendezvous, which Tony will be at, and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever will also be at the Minneapolis Convention Center coming up on April 19th and 20th. So it's perfectly timed to bring Tony in. And Tony, thank you very much for joining.
It's great to be here. I'm such a huge PFQF fan and supporter, so it's a thrill to be on your pod. Well, and you were one of the first guests on my pod, like in the first year, I think, I had you on.
Yeah, when I was kind of studying up for this, right, I think I was like maybe six or eight episodes.
And I recorded my first ever episode at Pheasant Fest with Lantani.
I saw that too, and you had Driesline early on. Yeah. And Jesse Diggins was on. We'll talk about your podcast. I'm interested to get your perspective. I've got that in the preparatory outline. This is your first visit to the headquarters, isn't it?
It is. It's great to be here. Of course, I've seen the address for years and mailed checks over here and all sorts of stuff. So absolutely, it's great to be here.
Well, thank you for coming here and the only snowmageddon of 2024.
I know it's finally, it turns to spring and it finally snows. We could have used some of that snow in like our December pheasant hunts,
or like cross country skiing in February.
That too,
goodness.
Yeah.
While this episode may get heavy, I mean, we've got The God of Wild Places as the title of your book. We're going to start off having a little fun, because you picked a fight with me and every other pointing dog owner.
Yep.
When you wrote this, did you know you were picking a fight?
Oh heck yeah.
Yeah, of course you did.
Of course.
All right. So on page 69 of The God of Wild Places, and I quote, "Countless are the times that we were hunting in a long line of guys and their pointing dogs, A shot rang out and a bird fell. And after some minutes of fruitless searching, I heard the plaintive cry over the prairie wind of one of those pointing dog owners. 'Hey, can you send your retriever over here?' Albert, my yellow lab, and I would venture down the line," because Albert wouldn't go without you. "So together we'd hoof it through cover to help some hunter owning a pointing dog and his uninterested pointer find a missing pheasant. I object, Reverend Jones."
Oh, but I could bring exhibits A through Z on this. I hunt with guys who run pointers mainly,
Really?
Yeah, mainly the guys I hunt with run pointers. And I have a lab, and then there's another guy who has a Springer. So we got two flushing dogs, but we got a lot of pointers, including some Vizslas, which is I've always said, like, at least I can spell the name. If you can't spell your dog breed on the first try, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a simple guy. I like labs. They're low maintenance. They're less expensive to buy. And it's you know what a lab is, Bob? It's the F-150 of dogs.
Okay? It's a Swiss Army knife.
It is. Right? It's like any vet can fix them, just like any mechanic can fix an F-150. Mm-hmm. And we love all of our dogs. And, and I do, you know, us. I feel like there's, I don't know, I haven't been a pheasant hunter that long, just like 15 years. Now, I'm adult onset hunter, which the book goes into quite a bit, but. Has it always been? People are. It seems like the scales have tipped toward pointers.
Mm. No, so I don't think that's quite true. That might be perception.
Yeah.
So just speaking
maybe
from our
pointer
service,
guys are just louder.
That could be true.
Team GSP.
Team GSP. So there's been a little bit of jockeying of some of the most popular breeds over the years. Mm-hmm. But over the 40-year history of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, 42, our member survey has always been Labrador Retrievers number one by far, no question.
Is that right?
Most popular bird dog within our membership.
You did say that when I came up on the stage at the parade with my dog. You said,
the
most popular dog, not only in America, but among, you know, PF and QF
members.
And
it's not even close,
okay,
honestly.
Okay.
And it never has
maybe
been
we're
closer.
Just humbler about it, us lab owners.
I disagree with that, too. So number one has always been labs.
Okay.
Number two through five have changed a little bit over the years. Short hairs occupy that now. I don't think that's been the case for all 40 years. I think just top of mind, it's labs, short hairs. Then it goes to Springers, Brittany's, and then I think five is English Setters, something like that. Mm-hmm. I think Brittany's have been number two in the past. Goldens have been up there, historically not as high today. I do think there's probably been a surge in, you know, short hairs have closed the gap a little bit. I mean, there's such a wide array of short and wire hairs too, I think, have surged. And then I think your perception is right that there's probably more pointer owners because there's a more understanding of all the diverse breeds of pointers, from Vizslas to Weimaraners to the Deutsch Wuchter, Deutsch Drahtar.
See, okay, spell it.
You can't
pronounce it or spell it.
Well, Wuchterhound. So Deutsch Wuchterhound, I don't think that's a pointer, which is why I backed off that one. Deutsch Kuzar, Langar, Drahtar, those are all pointing breeds.
Yeah.
Griffons.
And I've seen them on occasion retrieve. Sometimes, Bob, you're just doubling down on this. Sometimes, Bob, they even bring the bird all the way back to the owner, and they don't stop halfway and start chewing on it, which I've seen. My buddy with the draught, I mean, God, it's swearing at the dog running. Oh, don't chew the bird. And we're all like, that's your bird, John. You got to keep that bird.
You and I have never hunted before. I think we need to. We need to put this perception to rest.
We should. And here's the thing. Like, I get it. My dog, as I also write in the book, I write about a grouse hunt at our family land in central Minnesota. And, you know, he's not ideal. My dogs are not ideal for grouse hunting. I watch videos, you know, I'll watch the flush episode with you guys. Walking up in the boundary watch. You got your guns cracked open over your shoulders. You're like, it's just a walk in the woods. And if the dog's going point 600 yards away, you're like, oh, we'll just walk over there. Now, when you're grouse hunting with a lab, man, you are on your toes.
Well, and you probably know, part of it is the nose positioning of different breeds. So Labrador, and this is true of short hairs too, their nose is primarily on the ground.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas a setter that they train is for the nose to be up in the air.
Okay.
So they can scent a bird further off and thus point it before boosting it. And, you know, if you can get other, like, short hairs or whatever to get kind of in that middle where their nose is in the air, then they can point birds farther away, which is part of the reason, you know, labs are known for being able to track down cripples.
Sure.
Because they have that bloodhound.
Yes.
Nose to the ground. That's where, again, short hairs, based on my experience, they do put their nose to the ground and track cripples more readily than some of the dogs that have the nose in the air and are trained to purely point.
Yeah.
I think you can have the best of both worlds in a pointer. Some of it is pure genetics and some of it is training. But I just thought it'd be fun to start the conversation.
No, I get it. I get it. I will tell you this. When I'm out hunting, and it happens at least once a weekend, if not once a day, and I pheasant hunt probably I go to South Dakota for 6 4-day weekends a year. And then maybe I do a couple more, you know, drive days in Minnesota. But when my dog retrieves a cripple of that another guy shot, it brings me so much joy. And it's not just
especially if it's a pointing
dog. Not even just to rub it in the guy's face, because what it means is I'm going to be getting a beer. You know, somebody's buying me a beer at the end of the day. And people, oh, my gosh, Crosby is the greatest. Yeah. And, like, I could miss 15 shots in a day, and if my dog finds a bird that would have otherwise been lost, I'm just like, that's my day. That just makes my day.
So one of the greatest joys of my life was, so the rooster road trip, I think it's 4 years ago. My young pup now, who's four going on five, Gitchy, was really rudimentary pup. I think she was maybe, 6 or 8 months old at that point. We, as a group, dropped a rooster into a wetland, and it was her and like two pretty inexperienced dogs out with in the field at that moment. And Andrew, one of the guys I work with, is on camera. Like, oh no, the rooster's in the water. Like, somebody, we don't even have the right dogs here. We got to go get the lab. And Gitchy went out into the water, like, instantly brought it back. It was, honestly, that was her first wild bird retrieve.
That's amazing.
And it was, like, about chest puffed out, really pleased, you know.
Oh, I know that feeling.
So that was a great moment. Yeah, but I'm just jesting, because I've been in those situations where, you know, a lab will dig out a rooster and, you know, a whole bunch of other dogs have been right over that area or, you know, down that path.
But, or a lot of times the way we hunt is, you know, we come up, the dog's on a point, and we come up to it, and there's no rooster. There's no bird there. Like, there was a bird there.
Right, it's ran.
Those dogs are runners. You know, pheasant hunting's different than, and what I know is, like, I can't take my lab to Arizona and hunt Mern's quail or something like that. But I can duck hunt with him. So, you know, there's always the trade-offs, right?
Sure,
when you pick your breed. And I sometimes think, maybe I'll get a pointer to go with my lab.
I've read your book. No. There is no way.
I'm locked in.
You have committed yourself.
Yeah, it's true.
To last.
It's true.
So before we get into the book, kind of tell the backstory, who you are. For folks that don't know you, who is Tony Jones?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Minnesota. I did not grow up in a hunting family. I mean, it's one of the things we can get into a little bit. The spirituality of acquiring my own meat actually has been a big change in my adult life. But I grew up just a suburban kid in Edina and, you know, went to school and went to church youth group. And my grandparents had a family cabin in central Minnesota that we went to 3 or 4 times a summer. We never did anything in the woods. We drove straight through the woods to get to the lake, you know, and then we fished for sunnies. But that was about the extent of any kind of outdoorsy stuff we did. Otherwise, it was, you know, a youth of playing baseball, umpiring mainly. You and I have talked about this before, but I still umpire town team baseball all around Minnesota, which is a lot of fun. I've been an umpire for a long, long time. So I'm a baseball guy like you. went away to college, went straight to seminary, and went right into ministry, and just like life was clicking along, you know. Moved back to Edina. I was a pastor at my home church. I started writing books. I started, my profile started to rise. I went back out east to get a PhD, and all that time, like that decade, my life, my personal life was falling apart. I was just in a really, really bad toxic marriage with little kids. And finally, in the summer of 2008, it just completely came apart. And, you know, I mean, this isn't a churchy podcast, and I'm sure people, your listeners, have different views of church and organized religion and whatever. I'll just say, so I won't make sweeping statements, though I could. I'll just say about my particular experience is that the church is probably pretty good at taking care of hurting parishioners, not so great at taking care of hurting clergy, hurting pastors.
So what religion? I grew up Catholic, going Catholic school, and you know, that priesthood's a whole different sort of
deal.
Animal. What religion were you?
I grew up Congregationalist, which is a bit obscure. The Pilgrims were Congregationalists, so you know, there's a great history in the U.S. of Congregationalists. Today, most Congregationalist churches are part of a denomination called the United Church of Christ, or UCC. So you'll see those churches. There are a lot of them around the Upper Midwest. But my church wasn't part of that, but is of that same general ilk and similar to Presbyterian, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I went to seminary. Unlike your priest growing up, I could get married and have kids and that kind of deal. But I, you know, similar process of going to seminary, getting ordained, becoming a reverend, getting all my clerical vestments that I would wear, you know, and then starting the stuff of in the church life of serving communion to people and baptizing kids and preaching sermons and doing all that, yeah.
So the first part of your book focuses on this element of your life, the kind of the being a pastor and having this troubled marriage.
Yeah.
And it's very, it's the word that comes to mind is cathartic. At least my interpretation of you writing this book is cathartic. It's healing for you to put it out on in paper, that it's, this is as much for you to process what's happened in your life as it is for the reader. And it part of it is dealing with the perceived taboo over divorce from a pastor's perspective. How do you react to that?
No, I think you're right. You know, it's not an autobiography, it's a memoir. And if the difference is, a memoir is organized around a theme. And this isn't like I was born on this day and then I did this. Yes, you're right. The book actually opens on the day I am getting ordained in 1997, because it represented the culmination of everything that I had been thinking since I first said, I want to be a pastor when I was in seventh grade, you know? And I thought, here we go. I'm good to go. Like, smooth sailing from here on out. And as just about everybody who's listening knows, life doesn't go like we think it's going to go. You know, there's it's a rocky road or a curvy trail or whatever metaphor you want to use.
At some point, you realize you can't hit the curveball, you know, and right. The tigers aren't calling.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's exactly right. Something happens along the way and you think, yeah, it's not going exactly the way I planned. And then you know, you make changes. And so, yeah, it's for me, it was challenging and I was really discombobulated because so much of my identity was, I mean, I had become like, I don't know, I call myself a C-list Christian celebrity at the time. You know, I was like preaching, getting flown around the country, around the world to preach, you know, and people were buying my books and I was becoming kind of little bit famous, and my blog was like a big, like in the top 10 Christian blogs in the world. People were reading it, you know? Yeah, at the time when people blogged, you know, when that was the thing. And then it all just like, it's funny. I just today wrote an email this morning to all the people who endorsed my book, and probably, you know, some names might be familiar to your listeners, like Mark Norquist, the modern carnivore, and Jim Shockey, you know, the TV star, big game hunter from Canada, and a few, and then some other more, you know, spiritual type writers or whatever. But what I wrote them was my last book came out in 2015, right at this same time. This when we're recording this, I know it's going to air a little bit later, but we're right around Palm Sunday, and I was booked to preach Palm Sunday at a mega church, one of the most well-known churches in the country in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, and then fly to New York to do, during Holy Week, to do the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News and debate Bill O'Reilly, because he wrote a book about Jesus and I'd written a book about Jesus. And I was also, though, in the middle of a custody fight. And stuff went up online about me, and it all went away. In 48 hours. I lost the preaching gig. I lost the TV. I was doing other. I got on Morning Joe. That was like my one little media hit. And then the whole thing, my book just completely flopped. And my life went. So it's really wild to me to be coming out 9 years later. Longest gap I've gone without publishing a book in my adult life. It's been a long time, and this is a totally new type of book for me. Yeah, it's about hunting. You know, it's not what my old audience would even recognize. But it's been all to your point. It's been cathartic to write it, and now you just put it out there in the world and see what people think. You know, how it's received.
So I just got done reading the book, as you know, and it. To me, it feels like, you know, that first couple of chapters are very cathartic. And then there is, I was just listening to something else here, and it was like, the statement was, there is a moment at everything before and a moment in everything after. Mm-hmm. And it feels like that moment, the before and after, it wasn't necessarily the divorce. It was you finding the outdoors was the before and after. Like the divorce was the catalyst or the impetus that got you to the outdoors, but it's the outdoors connection in the book and in your life that changed the trajectory of where you were going and who you are today. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, that's back to the thing I said about my identity. So much of my identity was like, oh, I'm a Christian and I'm a pastor and I'm an Christian writer. And that was, and then suddenly I wasn't that anymore. All that was taken away. You know, people sometimes are like, would you choose your family over your career? And everyone's like, yeah, of course I would choose my family over my career. But nobody, it's such a high, nobody ever has to do that, you know? And I didn't have to either. No one gave me the choice. My career just disappeared in like 48 hours. It all went away. And then what was I? I was a dad who had full custody of his kids. I'm remarried happily. So like life in that way was the personal life kind of stabilized and was full of love and warmth and was amazing. But who was Tony as like a professional or a person in the world other than dad and husband, you know? And that's where I had to figure it out. And what I just was drawn to was going outside, like hunting, really. But you know, you and I share a love for the Boundary Waters. I go there every year. I now guide trips with pastors up there because, well, we could talk about that, but why I do that. But that was the thing that was giving me life. If organized religion used to give me some kind of life and fulfillment and identity, and it no longer did, suddenly the outdoors was doing that. And You know, so then I start, because I'm of my training and my, you know, the work I've done as a theologian and stuff, I look around and I think, well, why is that? So, like, one thing, one little thing that I bet all the outdoors men and women who listen to your podcast know is, like, there are no right angles in the woods. I grew up at a church, you know, you can imagine your Catholic church growing up or my church growing up, full of right angles. There's right angles everywhere. You know, the pews are set in the line, and there's the pulpit up in the front, and there's the rug is cut just this, blah, blah, blah. You know, everything's very orderly. There's actually a line in the Presbyterian Book of Worship that says worship should be done, quote, decently and in order. And nothing in the woods is decent or in order. You know what I mean? The woods, the where when we go out, when we're hoofing it through a cattail slough, or we're chasing grouse, or we're fishing or whatever, there's just, it's a mess. You know, nature is a mess. It's full. I look out your window right here and I see branches down on the ground and melting snow and a squirrel running around and the trees are, you know what I mean? Like, and I think, and I just was like, oh, that's my life. My life is not decent and in order. My life is a mess. I've got broken branches. Everything's kind of curved. There's new life growing where other things had died. I'm like, okay, yeah, I feel more at home out here than I do indoors.
So this is a goofy thought, but the right angles and the clean. So would that mean that pheasant hunters who like to walk edges of fields, you know, clockwise or counterclockwise around the perimeters are more religious, and the ones that like dive into the middle and zigzag around are
that could less be religious. That could have to do with their Myers-Briggs type, or I don't know. Yeah, you should do a strengths finder with all those hunters.
So you know, I kind of mentioned that moment connection in the outdoors sort of changed. And you were on local radio show here recently, the Four Outdoorsmen, talking about that moment. It was a duck hunt, right?
Yeah, it was a guy who lived in Minneapolis. He was a parishioner at the church where I was a pastor, and he took me up to Lake of the Woods. I tell the story really in depth in the book, but he took me deep into Canada. I mean, it was, I don't know what's the metaphor, trial by fire or being thrown into the deep end of the pool or something like that. This was not like, hey, let's go to a game farm and shoot some pen-raised pheasants or something. This was like, we're going to go where no one knows where we are. We're going to be gone for a week. And if something happens to us, they might find our bodies and they might not, you know. And I loved it. And I loved it so much. I mean, I loved it probably more than I should, not just because it was like, oh man, this is so cool being outdoors, and my dad wasn't a hunter and now this guy's like mentoring me. No, it was more than that. It was more like, oh, this is the piece that I'm lacking in my personal life, and I can find it out here. I can't find it at home, and
when
I can't
you say
find it at
peace
church.
You mean peace.
Right. Something in my soul.
Yeah.
I experience peace, particularly there was a particular night that I write about in the book where we got lost in the duck boat on the way home in the dark, and the fog had come down, and Lake of the Woods is, you know,
enormous.
And what, 15,000 islands,
right,
or something? I mean,
you turn a corner and you're completely lost.
And Doug, this guy who took me out, he had no GPS. I mean, he was just like memory. I think he had a couple maps under the seat or something. I mean, we're in a Lumacraft duck boat with two dogs, you know, 50 decoys, and I've got a million candle watt spotlight hooked up to a car battery between my legs, because this was pre LED and you know, it was pre all that stuff. And I loved it. I mean, that was the thing. You'd think, oh my God, you know, some people would go do that and they'd be like, I'm never going back.
Right.
I was cold. I was wet. I felt unsafe. Like, I'm glad I did it once, but I never need to do that again. You know, we've all taken people hunting. We're like, thank you for the opportunity. Not my thing. And I was the opposite. I'm like, this is my thing. And then I was 30 And then it didn't happen again
until
I was 40. Because that was the decade of
the
my
turmoil.
Life. Yeah, where I was like, we moved to New Jersey for me to get my PhD, but also to try to like get away from our families of origin and see if we could solve our marriage by being distant. Well, you know, your problems travel with you. You can't run away from problems like that. It was all this travel and I'm frantically trying to make money and then get into a house I can't afford, and it all collapses. You know, it all completely collapses between like 2010 and 2015. But those were also the years that I got Albert and I started hunting. Yeah.
And it feels like, and this I think is where you and I first connected originally. And I think it was, you wrote about it in the Star Tribune, how you traded, for lack of a better, preaching services to communities in North and South Dakota in exchange for pheasant hunting opportunities, access, places, you know, people to take you and give you an opportunity. And I think I read this story in the Star Trib, and then maybe we connected and had you on KFAN.
That's right.
And like I mentioned in the opening, pheasant hunting and bird dogs are absolutely integral part of this book. Bird dogs get their own section,
whole chapter.
Tell the story of the most unique trade in pheasant hunting history.
Isn't that funny? Well, I mean, it was 15 years ago actually, and still, you know, I was blogging, people blogged at the time, people read my blog, a lot of pastors read my blog, and like I said, I didn't grow up hunting, and you know, you've talked about this before with people, and you've mentored hunters. It can be hard. It's a steep learning curve if you did not grow up hunting. There's not only the firearms aspect of it, and you got to go through your hunter safety, and you got to buy a firearm or borrow. You know, it's weird borrowing people's guns. Then there's the whole like, who do I hunt with? I don't have any buddies who hunt. That's not the community I move around in. And then there's like, and now where do I hunt?
Right.
You know, yeah, there's public land, but I remember one time early on, I'm like, well, I'm just going to go out to Western Minnesota with my dog. And this was, I think Albert was very young, you know, and I'm just going to go walk public land and hunt. And so, I mean, I drive by this same public spot, you know, there's a big PF sign and whatever, and it's with this big one curve in the road, and I mean, I could probably find it on Onyx, but I went out, and I didn't even have an electric collar for my dog, and I'm like, okay, here we go. Now, I didn't know what I was doing, and off he went, and I saw him flush two roosters, and he kept running, Bob, and I don't know that I saw that dog for an hour. I thought I'll never see him again. I'm like crying. My heart is just in my throat. I'm sweating. I'm like going into shock, thinking like, what am I? I have this little new brand new dog, and I didn't know what I was doing is my point in all that. Well, around that same time, I posted on my blog, well, what do I have to offer? You know, I can preach. I'm good at that. I mean, I don't have anything else to barter. You know what I mean? Like, I know guys barter with farmers to get access to their land. Oh, let me fix your tractor. I don't have any. I'm a kid from Edina who has a PhD in theology. What am I going to offer? I can preach. So I posted, I will preach for free in exchange for hunting on my blog. It was just like, I don't know. I was just like sending this out into the universe and seeing what would come back to me. And I got an email back from the Episcopal priest in Huron, South Dakota.
Oh, wow.
And I, like, you know, looked on Wikipedia, Huron, home of the world's largest pheasant. It's got, like, good sign. That's a good sign. Yes, how soon can I come? Mother Jean, she's still there. She's a dear friend of mine. I thank her in the acknowledgments of the book. She said, come on out. Come on out. I know guys who hunt. And I'd love to have you. I love your blog, and come and preach. She didn't care what was about me on the internet or my person. She was like, just come on out. We'll figure it out. And so I did. I drove out there, and she introduced me to Jorge Vicuña. And Jorge has become just one of my dearest friends in the world. There's an episode of the Flush TV show about our friendship that mm-hmm. has just been on YouTube now for a couple weeks, and people can watch that. And it's Scott Franzen just did an incredible job of telling the story of our friendship, because in that 15 years, not only have we become friends and hunted and hunted and hunted together, but he's gone through two different types of cancer, you know, ups and downs, and we've just been there for each other, you know. It's been really amazing.
And he's a major character in the book.
And he is. Yeah. So, but there's another example of, like, here's a guy, he didn't have to say yes to his pastor, to his priest, and say, yeah, I'll take some random dude, you know, from the internet. You're just, no, right. Yeah, you know, he was like, yeah, I'll take the guy out. I'll take the guy out. Right. And I'm 55, Jorge's 72. So, you know, whatever, 18 years, 17 years older than me. He was incredible. He taught me so much. I knew so little about hunting, about pheasant hunting, about any hunting. Mm. And he taught me so much. And, I mean, it's the group has grown that we hunt with, but I've hunted with him ever since. And I have gotten offers to preach and hunt in North Dakota and Iowa and Illinois. And it's still an offer if any of your listeners want to go to reverendhunter.com and get in touch with me. I'll do it.
North Dakota, South Dakota, Illinois, Iowa so far on the list?
That's right. I've had offers from other places that I've never quite been able to pull off.
How do you feel about quail hunting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, how will my lab do? Not great?
No, could for sure. It? Yeah, really? Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. 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 Particularly bobwhites.
Oh, yeah. I mean, here's the other thing is that, so I got sole custody of my kids and in 2015. So that's been about the last decade of my life. And I've had these buddies like, oh, you got it. Yeah. You got to come out. Like, let's go to Montana and do this. And you got to shoot an antelope and you got to switch to bow hunting. And how about fly fishing? You got to be a fly fisherman. Why are you, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, can you just let me, I guess, got to get these kids out of the house. And so now the kids are out of the house and it's been very sweet. Like, three different podcast listeners have gifted me with fly rods. So because I keep saying this on my podcast, I'm gonna fly fish. I just give me some time. So yes, all that to say, I am ready to expand my horizons of hunting now that I'm an empty nester.
Before you became an empty nester, though, what I feel like is another big component of the book was throughout your children's childhood, there was marital strife. But the connection to nature, the outdoors, from my perspective, particularly pheasant hunting, created a stronger connection with your kids.
With my two boys, for sure. Yes. That's right. There are stories about each of them in there. And particularly my youngest, who's really as rabid about the outdoors as I am and has gone on a lot of trips with me. So, there are moments in the book where they're with me and I'm learning lessons through them, you know, through their experiences.
Yeah.
And a big part of parenting, I think, after a very ugly divorce is relinquishing control. I mean, for me, it was relinquishing control in parenting and realizing these kids are going to be okay. Their therapists would keep telling me that, like, Tony, they're going to be okay. Like, you just need to parent. You just be a dad. You don't need to panic. Like, we're going to get through this. All of us together. Like him, the therapist, me and the three kids, and Courtney, my wife. So we did get through it. And so there are these moments in the book where something's happening with one of my – there's this moment where we're at a piece of land that Jorge's brought us to. It's this little patch of switchgrass. It's like a postage stamp in the middle of a cornfield. And Jorge's like, I think there's birds in here. And as he will often do, he put my youngest son, Aiden, on, let's see, that would have been the southwest corner, because he just was like, I think that's where the birds are going to fly out. And I kid you not, Aiden missed six roosters. Like, boom, 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 reload, 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 boom, boom, boom. Missed all six. Gets back in the truck, and he's like, I don't know, he's 13 at the time. His face is red. He's just like fighting back tears of anger and embarrassment, you know, and Jorge's son, Nick, who's younger than me, but, you know, he was maybe 30 at the time. He's just said something like, you know what? We all miss. I've shot so many rounds through this barrel, and I've missed more than I've hit. That's just part of hunting. That's all he needed to say. And everything within me was like, I got to fix this for my kid. Mm-hmm. Like, can I grab a pheasant and hold it out for him to shoot? Mm. No, that was the lesson, you know. And Nick delivered the little sermon better than I could have. I, thank God, had the wherewithal to keep my mouth shut and not try to fix it. And just Nick just had that little – and we all know that, right? We know that feeling from hunting. There's a lot in the book about failure, about risk and failure, and how we try to mitigate that out of modern life. You know, we really do. Mm-hmm. Everything from seat belts to carbon monoxide, you know, it's all good. It's all good stuff. But we also lose something when we mitigate all failure out of life, all risk. And I think hunting is a way where we can deliberately put ourselves into moments where you're going to fail more than you're going to succeed.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that about hunting because it's true to life. Mm-hmm. And it's a great lesson for a kid too.
Yeah, that comes through loud and clear in the book. Couple things, more like quick hitters for
you.
One thing that really resonated with me, and I believe wholeheartedly, is you have a disdain for the word sport used in reference to hunting. Give me your perspective on why hunting is not a sport.
Yeah. I guess I'd say because I think that the species who co-inhabit this planet with us are, I think we're all connected. We're all part of this one, you know, planetary ecology, I guess you'd say. And we're brothers and sisters with them, to put kind of almost familial or spiritual language around it. Mm. And I don't, just like I wouldn't use a fellow human being for my sporting pleasure, I wouldn't use another species for my sporting pleasure. And yeah, I've heard you talk about that before too. Yeah, and there are some words I think that just, they're euphemisms that get brought into life to try to sand the rough edges off of things. And I personally, as an author, and just as a human being, I don't want to rub the, I don't, when someone dies, I don't say they passed away or that they crossed to the other side or I just say they died, you know, and I say to people, I kill animals and I butcher them and I eat them. Mm. I don't harvest them, you know,
sure. Bag.
I don't bag them. I mean, I get it. And especially as writers, you want to find synonyms. You don't want to keep saying the same thing over and over again. But it's funny, Bob, I just found out yesterday, I gave a talk, but well before the book came out, last October at a pastor's conference. And there were maybe 350 people there. And the guy knew I had this book coming out, the guy who organized it, and he asked me to speak about the book. So I actually opened by saying, my opening line was one of the opening lines of the book. It was, I don't remember the first time I killed an animal, but I remember the first time I killed an animal in front of my children. Hmm. And then I tell a story about a duck hunt where the dog brings a duck back to me that's crippled but not dead, and I wring the duck's neck in front of the kids. And I tell the story. This was like 6 months ago, right? I found out yesterday that several people got up and walked out and left the conference angry that they had to hear about, you know, somebody killing an animal. Hmm. That's not why they came to a pastor's conference. Meanwhile, of course, in the hallway, the turkey sandwiches for lunch were all laid out,
right,
waiting for them.
Right.
Right.
The Aldo Leopold reference is right there in front of us.
They wanted their box lunch with their turkey sandwich, and they didn't want to think about the animal it came from. They didn't want to think about the anonymous person in a factory who butchered that, killed that turkey and butchered that turkey. Right. They just want to eat their turkey guilt-free. And good, get up and walk out if that's your thing, because I think those of us who hunt, we're so much more in touch with that, with our food, right? And that's just, again, it's another one of those things that I think you and I share, and a lot of us who hunt share, and that I wrote about in the book. There's a whole chapter on butchery and meat, which I already am hearing from. Now, I'll tell you another quick hitter story about that. A mutual friend of ours, we drove to Pheasant Fest together, Mark Norquist. I'll just use his name because, you know, this, I don't think it's a secret story. Mark and I drove, but I left a book with his wife when we left. And then we got back from Pheasant Fest, and Mark's unloading his stuff out of my truck, and his wife comes out, and she's like, "Oh my gosh, I stayed up all night reading your book. I loved it." And this is not like 55-year-old suburban mom is not really my target audience in a book about hunting, really.
Sure,
but
sure.
So I was like, that's amazing. That's great. And then tears came to her eyes. And she said, that chapter about butchering the deer, that really hit me hard. About that, about how you take the deer from deer to venison. And there's this gray, there's this liminal moment when it's not a deer, but it's not yet venison.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she was like, "I've been eating venison all my life," because her dad hunts. Obviously, Mark is a big hunter. And she's like, "I'd never thought about that before."
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, my gosh.
I thought that was exceptionally well written. That might have been the best piece of writing in the whole book.
Thanks.
How you positioned it going from deer, butchering process, transition to venison. Mm. That was really well done.
Thank you.
The other related to meat, what grabbed me in that section as well was it's page 128. You write a lot of meat. So you're cleaning the birds for what happened before this quote. You're cleaning the birds for a group who they're probably tired after a couple of days of hunting. They're tired of cleaning birds.
It's cold out.
It's cold. And they're like, let's just breast them out.
Or we can drop them at this lady who cleans them for $4.50 a bird, and we pick them up, and they're in baggies.
Yeah. And you're not having any of it.
Nope.
Because the cleaning part is critically important to this process and this connection for you.
For me, yeah.
But I also love just the thought that these lines elicit in the factory, olfactory sense, like the sense of smell and taste. And a lot of the meat from these pheasants will go into pheasant sausage, ground with pork fatback, fennel seeds, garlic, lemon rind, Madeira, am I saying that right? Madeira wine, then piped into casings and hung in the garage. My family's favorite pheasant fare. When I read that, I was like, oh, I need to trade for some of that.
Oh, for sure. I'm making it next weekend.
Are you really?
And yes. And that's Hank Shaw's. That's one of Hank Shaw's pheasant sausage recipes in his pheasant quail
cocktail.
Sounds incredible. It's incredible. And I make it every year, and my family just they go crazy for it. So yeah, right. That's right. It's all part of it. It's a lot of work. Like, I don't deny that. It's a lot of work. And yet I do it because it's super important to me.
It illustrates, in my perspective, you know, this isn't a huge book. I mean, it's not, you can read this in, you know, two nights, three nights. But it does a really nice job of A to Z, kind of the thought process of the connection to the outdoors from the, because there's a habitat component of how you have fallen in love with this land you grew up with, right? And the connection with the birds and the dogs and the people you hunt with and all the way to the meat at the end and the table. It is a spiritual journey that we all have taken, just whether how much we want to put the term spiritual is sort of in the mind of the beholder.
I think you're right. I mean, I think my hope is that people who read this book, your listeners who are crazy about pheasant hunting and quail hunting like we are, will read the book and be like, yeah, yes, I've had the same experience. All I've got is I've got a PhD in theology, so it's just like it's hardwired in me to think about the bigger meanings of things, mm-hmm. and to then try to draw whatever it is, like philosophical resources onto to try to say what is this that we're experiencing? How can we understand it? How can we talk mm-hmm. about it? Like those kind of things. So yeah, I don't think it's unique what I've experienced.
I had that impression too, because I was thinking, boy, this is a lot like Walden, Henry David Thoreau, in the transcendentalist sort of perspective, the connection to spirituality through nature.
I think there's a line of people we would consider outdoors writers, mm-hmm. but if you read them closely, they were very spiritual in their perspectives. And that includes Emerson and Thoreau. I think that line goes through John Muir. Hmm. I think that line goes through Sigurd Olson and Aldo Leopold. Mm-hmm. I think it goes through Gary Snyder and Jim Harrison. You know, and each one of those guys is different. I mean,
I see you giggling a little bit, smiling when you say Jim Harrison.
I mean, too. Jim's a funny cat, because he was like, I mean, Gary Snyder was kind of an avowed Buddhist, Zen Buddhist, and he wrote The Practice of the Wild, and he was very good friends with Harrison, and Harrison seems to have had some kind of Buddhist proclivities that he writes about at times, but he also had a proclivity to drink an entire bottle of Burgundy every day, and like had his eye poked out by a girl when he was 9 years old. Mm. I mean, he's what a character. He's one of the great literary figures. Yeah. But if you read his nonfiction, mm-hmm. About hunting and about the UP and his move out west and about his dogs, there are a few Harrison quotes in there. Yeah, it's maybe not front and center, but you find the spirituality of the outdoors for him as this kind of crazy Zen Buddhist guide, like you do with Sigurd, who's, went to a Presbyterian church in Ely and guest preached on occasion. Hmm. The spirituality of the outdoors has been really important for a lot of our most revered nature writers, and the ones on whom we lean in the conservation movement to try to save land. It's tricky, and you and I talked about it a little before we went, before we hit record. But it's a little bit tricky writing a book about God, because in the outdoor space, mm-hmm. it's a very secularized space these days, which is understandable because we live in a very pluralistic society and people don't want to be preached at when they go to a PF banquet, which is why I try to write an invocation that is sacred without being sectarian, mm-hmm. at the banquet. That can go too far the other way, where we're like, no, we're just talking about habitat or climate change or in these very secularist terms, when we all know, those of us who love outdoors places or love the boundary waters, it's a spiritual connection that I have to the boundary waters. I bet you too. And that I have to my dogs. And I bet you too. We maybe put different language around it, but it's more than just, it's not so sterile, that it's soulful. It's soulful connections. And so that's,
it's a little bit how we position it in our minds and in our language. And what I mean by that is, so many of us go to the outdoors to escape the cacophony of what's happening in the world around us. In your case, it was to escape marital strife and what was right.
Yep.
For others, escape the political.
Right.
You know, escape the stress of work. Like outdoors, nature is escapism. But part of that escapism, I think what you're saying is, it is the P-E-A-C-E piece. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is the spiritual connection, however you interpret that in your own personal life, whether it's religious, whether it's transcendentalism, whether it's right in that feeling of comfort. We all can put our own definition on it, but it is sort of the human condition that the outdoors brings us joy, comfort, and P-E-A-C-E, peace.
Peace, yeah. Yeah, I was invited. I told this story when I spoke on the Path to the Upland stage at Pheasant Fest, that I was invited into a new crew to hunt. My son and I were just this year in Iowa, and we went down and we 2 days of hunting. And we hunted all day with me and some guys my age and then my son and some guys his age. And then at the end of the day, we went into town to the grandpa's house and had dinner there. Had a little wild game dinner. And, you know, I don't know, we shot one or two pheasants and I shot a rabbit and somebody had some venison. So we were doing a little – everyone was cooking and we had the, you know, NFL. It was probably like wild card weekend was on and – and I'm sitting there with the grandpa, the guy whose land we just hunted all day. And commercial comes on. He starts pulling out his phone and says, oh, I got to show you the latest thing about, and then fill in the blank politician. Mm. It was some meme about it, and he wanted to show me and all the. And I said to him, hey, all due respect, it's so nice of you to let us hunt your land. But I just have this rule. I do not talk politics on hunting trips. He's like, oh, yeah, I get it. But you just got to see this. Yeah. It's so funny. You wouldn't believe what he or she did today, you know. I'm like, really. I'm not kidding. I really, really. You're not going to convince me. I'm not going to convince you. Yeah. Let's just have a beer, watch some football, and thanks for letting us hunt your land. But, you know, it's a funny story, but it's also like, just what you're talking about, every spiritual tradition, whether it's part of organized religion or not, has practices that put up boundaries and that guard. You know, people have silence, or they fast and they don't eat, every tradition has these things, but they're all to guard us so we can have these things you're talking about, have joy and have peace. We can only do that if we actually build up some practices around that. Like, for instance, as I tell the guys I'm mentoring, you know, we're in South Dakota. We walk around a field for an hour and a half. We get in the truck. We got a 30-minute drive to the next farm. And what do they do? Each one of them, what do? Pull out their phone immediately. Mm. Pull out their phone. Mm. I say, put away your bleep, bleep. I'm a former pastor, so I can swear. I can swear openly. Put away your bleeping phone. Uh-huh. I don't want to see it again. Uh-huh. You do not need your phone. We're hunting today.
Right. Focus.
Nothing is happening on the internet
that
is possibly more interesting than the conversation we're going to have about how we hunted that last field and how we're going to hunt this next field. Mm-hmm. That's what we should be talking about. Mm-hmm. Or talk about our lives. Talk about our wives and girlfriends. Talk about our, you know, whatever. So, yes, I think it's so valuable for us. It's the same reason. It's like, what a joy to go to the Boundary Waters where your phone doesn't work. Mm-hmm.
For now, it's getting close.
No, right? I know.
There's parts of the Boundary Waters where there's towers now.
I know. And that's why the people I take in there, I say, you're leaving it. Yeah. You're leaving it in the car because
pull the battery.
Right. Yeah, there is. But I need it for a camera.
Yeah. What if you catch that monster lake trout?
Yeah,
right?
I know.
In the book, you do mention talking to other clergy, other pastors about hunting and fishing. And that got me to wondering, are the outdoors, is hunting and fishing pastimes, lifestyles, that's commonplace?
No.
So it is.
Really isn't.
Okay.
It really isn't. Pastors are soft. I mean, somebody can clip that and post that on Instagram. Because I think most pastors would agree. Like the reason pastors reach out to me and say, "Will you teach me how to hunt? I feel like I'm missing something," or "Will you take me to the boundary waters? I'm scared, but I know I need to do it." Is a lot of, you know, it's a sedentary job. It's a people. It's a people job. Pastors go into that line of work because they have big hearts and they care about people. And they're social animals. I don't know many who hunt. But I'm doing my best to change that. Yeah. Of course, as a former pastor, I have a lot of friends who are pastors, but I don't even talk politics with them on hunting trips.
So you could create a whole R3 movement around reaching the religious sect.
Yeah, it would be a big push, I think. That'd be a tough one, but I suppose, yes, you could do a little R3 for pastors. Yeah,
nuns for conservation.
Yeah.
No? Maybe?
Sure, why not? We'll try it, yeah.
I loved the book. I really did. It was very meaningful. It was entertaining. It was humorous. I was reading, maybe Instagram or something you put out, like people are loving the companions section, which your chapter, which is your dogs.
About the dogs.
And I would agree. You gained a lot of momentum in that section. It felt like, as the beginning, it is catharsis, getting through. And then it is, there's a section about connecting with the outdoors. And then joy enters into the book in the companion section, and then you're rolling.
Oh, that's nice.
You talked about the risk component. To me, the risk component was part of the joy. It's like, life is short. We don't want to live in an I don't want to live in an institutional Nerf world.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Living in in the outdoors is, it comes with some risk, and with that comes great reward. So it really, really moved me through a natural progression. And I'd love to recommend this book to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Members, as I mentioned, there's a lot about bird dogs in pheasant hunting in particular here. There's grouse hunting, there's deer hunting, there's elk hunting, there's meat processing.
death. There's death.
I mentioned a moment ago, there's a very strong connection to our habitat mission. While it's focused on your Northwoods cabin country, which is rough grouse and woodcock country, it does symbolize very similar connection or same connection that our Quail Forever audience feels and Pheasants Forever audience feels about whatever their little slice of heaven is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just today I was on the phone with a guy talking about how we do prescribed burns because we're on that land, we're fighting a couple different invasive species, and we're trying to manage our land to be as friendly toward wildlife as possible. And I shoot a few grouse in there and a deer or two every year, but there's a lot going on there. And it's our little, in the grand scheme of things, what's our 276 acres of family land, but for us it's everything. But then also I'll be in South Dakota in May with a chainsaw working tree belts with a 79-year-old guy who owns farms out there. He went to the banquet with me, and we've planted trees, and we're going to be cutting, those Russian olive trees, man. When you're trying to walk a tree belt, those Russian olive trees, they want to tear up all your beautiful PF shirts that you have. So we'll be cutting things in there, and we'll be doing some burns, and we're all about the habitat, the guys I hunt with.
If folks want to check out the book, we can Google.
Yeah.
The God of Wild Places. Yeah. Is there any place you want people to look?
Well,
the easiest
way is just to go godofwildplaces.com, which will take you to my Reverend Hunter website. I mean, back to the story of, like, it was actually a mutual friend, Bob Timmons at the Star Tribune, who gave me that moniker. The Reverend Hunter was what he called that article in the Star Tribune about me going trading, hunting. So I got this name, and then, I mean, this, you know, it became kind of my little brand or whatever. My podcast is named that, and my website. But if you just type in godofwildplaces.com, it'll take you to that. You can buy, obviously, from Amazon and Barnes & Noble and bookshop.org if you want to support a local bookstore. There's an audiobook that I recorded at, I mean, this is all small world. Yeah. I recorded at Ron Scher Productions with Brandon, you know, the producer extraordinaire of Talk North podcasts.
Sure.
And there's, you know, it's been fun being on the Flush, and there's going to be a little thing about me on Minnesota Bound about when this episode releases.
Great.
Here. So yeah, godofwildplaces.com. You can also, on that site, you can actually order one directly from me, and I'll sign it and,
cool,
and mail it to you. Yeah.
Reverend Hunter podcast. If folks haven't heard it before and they like what you're dishing on today's episode,
yeah,
on the Wing, throw out a couple of episodes that you are particularly proud of.
Well, the one with you.
That I saw my poll quote is, I learned more from my dogs than any single human being, right?
Is that good?
That was great. Yeah, yeah. I think that's true.
No, that was good. And we talked baseball and we talked dogs. Boy, there's a few that are, you know, that are really good. The one with Julia Schrenkler that was earlier this year.
Who's a mutual friend has been on a couple of these podcasts. She was on Becoming in a Bird Hunter as an Adult way back, like 2 years ago. And she was also on an episode more recently with my buddy John Zeman. She's part of the dog training crew last summer.
Yeah.
And if folks look at the Franke video about her and her short hair Wren and her newer pup, that came out right before hunting season this year, last fall.
And that's what I interviewed her about.
Oh,
is
that
okay.
Franke, that episode.
Yeah, which was cool. And then, like, I don't know, of the famous, I haven't had anybody super famous on there, but, you know, I've got.
Yeah, Jim Shockey.
Jim Shockey is what I was going to say. Yeah. Jim Shockey.
Jesse Diggins, for folks that don't know.
Yes.
You know, Olympic gold medalist.
Oh, Jesse's
in
cross-country
skiing. Her parents have Brittany's, I believe, and her dad, I think her dad's a bird hunter, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, Jessie was great, and I was very fortunate to have her on. She was promoting her book, and that's what, you know, she wanted to talk about. Jim Shockey, for being a famous person, he was incredible.
Mm.
I mean, like, as a human being, he's incredible. His wife was dying.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he comes on my podcast, and then he reads the manuscript of my book and writes this incredible endorsement, and then he emails me about how he was reading passages to his dying wife. I mean, incredible. Yeah, so he's not just a TV star. Like, he's a great guy. But so is, you know, Travis Frank has been on he's a man. Travis is a man of deep faith and came on my podcast and talked about that, which I think he liked to do because it's not something he does in his –
Flush.
Yeah, right. So, you know, it comes out every other week. And if people like this conversation, it's a lot of conversations like this.
Yeah. I mentioned in the preview, which was probably startling, like weird for some people, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Rendezvous coming up here in the Twin Cities, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. We'll have a booth there selling memberships, talking to folks. You've been part of BHA for a while. You've been to rendezvous before. You're going
to
be at
I haven't
this
been to a rendezvous
oh,
before.
Oh, I thought you were. Okay.
No, but I'm going to be at this one all 3 days. And, I mean, I'll just be like everybody else. I think I'm going to volunteer a little bit, but I'm going to be walking around, and I might have, if people see me with a backpack, it's probably full of books I'm trying to sell. So you can definitely buy a book from me at Rendezvous. But I think, you know, you and I think I have three orgs that I am passionate about, I love and support financially and other ways, you know, emailing my legislators about. It's PFQF, it's Sportsmen for the Boundary Waters, and it's BHA. Those are my three. I feel like those three represent pretty much the entirety of what I love about the outdoors, and they all three organizations are advocating for stuff I care about. So yeah, Rendezvous, and I'm sure Sportsman will have a booth there, and PF will have a booth there. So I'm going to be there, and I'd love to meet anybody who has listened to this pod and or saw me at Pheasant Fest or whatever. I would love to meet anybody. And
so I strategically asked for the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever booth to be right next to the Sportsman for the Boundary Waters.
Smart.
So I can double shift and help out in both places.
That's great.
So I'll be there all day Saturday. I'll get done. It'll be a long day because I'll get up at 4 a.m., go to KFAN.
Oh, boy.
Do Fan Outdoors from 6 to 8, then roll to the Minneapolis Convention Center.
For the whole day.
And then I'll be there. But it'll be a blast. So
I think it'll be really fun. And I know of – I know, on Friday morning, there's going to be a adult onset hunter panel that Dave Simonette's going to be on. Yeah. Mark Norquist is the moderator of that panel.
Cool.
And I think there's going to be, you know, there's storytelling, and there's Hal Herring, who hosts the podcast and Blast, and what a hoot that guy is.
Yeah, right.
I mean, one of my favorite people. He's going to do Friday Night Alive podcast and Pint Night, and a lot of fun stuff going on. It's really great they brought it to the Twin Cities.
Yeah. So folks that are listening and will be coming to that, look for Tony.
Yep.
With a backpack full of books. He'll sign one for you.
Yeah, I might just sit there right in the Sportsman or the PF and it's right outside your booth and try.
There we go. Closing thoughts as we round third and head towards home for a couple of baseball guys.
Yeah, what do you think? What I'm thinking about right now is two things. Turkey hunting. And the new slide rule where you can't, block a base. A fielder can't, put his leg down in front of a second base on a steal. So I umpire a lot of town ball, which if people don't know, it's a big deal in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It's like college players and players in their 20s usually. And a lot of times I'm alone. It's a one-man umpiring crew. So I'm having to call. You know, I'm calling the baller a strike, and then I'm having to get that. If somebody's stealing, I have to get that mask off and try to get an angle all the way down to second base. And now I got a whole nother thing I got to think about. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking about turkey hunting.
You mentioned in the book I don't believe in the book you've ever shot a turkey.
Well,
is that
there's like a postscript that says at the time of publication, then I finally had shot a turkey.
Okay.
But what I write is, but the story was so unnoteworthy that it doesn't even merit being written about. So if you meet me, ask me about it sometime. So
there you go.
If you meet me at Rendezvous, you can say, tell me about the time you shot a turkey, and I'll tell you. And it's so anticlimactic.
Thank you for doing this.
It has to do with getting out of a truck and on my driveway at the cabin and, there's a turkey after years and 15 years of sitting in a blind. Yeah. Okay. No, thanks for having me. It's such a blast to see you. And here's what I thought to myself. If I can make Bob laugh just once, it'll all be worth it.
Oh, come on. You know I giggle nonstop. 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. Saturday morning. And pretty much every podcast.
I love it.
The Reverend Tony Jones, that's the name of the podcast. The book, The God of Wild Places, website, godofwildplaces.com.
Yep.
Check out the book there. Folks, thank you very much for listening. I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog, especially those pointers.
And the labs.
Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.